From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet journalist Forrest Sawyer. He's anchoring an ABC News magazine that premieres on Sunday. Sawyer has often filled in for Ted Koppel on Nightline. During the Gulf War, he broke away from the Pentagon's press pool system to broadcast from the front and from a newly liberated Kuwait. Also today, the secret history of the German bomb. We talk with Tom Powers about his new book, which examines American plans to kidnap or assassinate Germany's top physicist during World War II, Werner Heisenberg. And TV critic David Bianculli previews two concert specials on PBS, paying tribute to Bob Dylan and Stephen Sondheim. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. White House and military officials in Frankfurt, Germany, say the airdrop to eastern Bosnia is continuing. Deirdre Berger has more.
At Rhein-Main Air Force Base in Frankfurt, planes have been loaded for the fourth mission to drop humanitarian aid packages in eastern Bosnia. At a news conference, Base Commander Don Loringer said the U.S. is pressing ahead with the airdrop. Loringer called the airdrop so far a success. He said the military has firm information that at least 15 of the 30 parcels dropped the first night over Sarska reached their intended target. Military officials on base said they are working together with UN representatives to respond to the new situation of fleeing refugees in the region. The past few days, Serbian Bosnians have stepped up fighting in some of the areas where humanitarian aid is being dropped. General Loringer says U.S. military officials will soon fly to Moscow to discuss Russian participation in the airdrop. For National Public Radio, this is Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
United Nations officials say that thousands of civilians are facing winter weather and Serbian gunfire as they try to escape from besieged towns and villages in eastern Bosnia. A representative of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees said about 10,000 people are stranded in the open and exposed to constant shelling in the ruins of the town of Konjevic Polje. He said that Serbian forces have also driven Bosnian civilians out of the town of Serska. The UN representative, Anders Levinson of Denmark, charged that the Serbs won't let UN relief workers in until they've killed all the Bosnian civilians or forced them to surrender. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen said today that the president is receiving briefings on events in Waco, Texas, where the standoff continues with an armed sect leader. But Bentsen says that decisions on how to handle the situation will be made by officials on the scene. In Waco, Bill Zeeble with member station KERA says authorities are forced to play a waiting game.
Officials with the FBI and Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms confirmed today 18 children and two adult women have been released from the compound. FBI Special Agent Jeffrey Jamar said agents had been hopeful the standoff was going to end yesterday afternoon following an hour-long broadcast message from sect leader David Koresh. But Jamar said Koresh changed his mind because God told him to.
Koresh refused to honor his promise and has indicated he will keep his promise to come out when he receives further instruction from God.
Negotiators say they believe Koresh is wounded, but don't know how badly. Officials reiterated they'll take however long is required to settle this matter without further bloodshed. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Zeeble in Waco.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 4 points to close at 3,404. Advances led declines by 2-1. This is NPR. Reports from Belgrade say that no one was hurt in a minor explosion outside the U.S. Embassy. The Associated Press quoted a State Department official who said the blast cracked a window in the building but caused little other damage. The official, who asked not to be identified, said the blast occurred at night after most people had left the building. Belgrade is the capital of Serbia and what remains of the former Yugoslav Federation. Albert Sabin, who invented a polio vaccine used around the world, died today at the age of 86. His family said he died in Washington of congestive heart failure. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
In the early 1960s, 100 million Americans lined up for a familiar ritual. They swallowed sugar cubes containing Albert Sabin's vaccine to prevent polio. Anthony Fauci, a friend and colleague of his from the National Institutes of Health, says Sabin's vaccine changed the face of human history.
For for the people who are old enough to remember when we were having polio epidemics, it is more than just a ritual. It's a reminder of what an extraordinary impact the polio vaccine has had on our society.
In most parts of the world today, polio is now little more than a medical curiosity and no longer a dread disease, in large part because of the Sabin vaccine. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
The United Auto Workers Union said today that more than 16,000 of its workers have taken General Motors' offer of early retirement. That's thousands more than were expected to apply for the plan, which is designed to help GM reduce its blue-collar workforce in North America. The early retirement was offered to workers who were 50 or older with more than 10 years of service. The plan was accepted by about 7,000 more workers than GM expected. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You can add a new entry to the growing list of TV news magazines. It's called Day One, and it premieres this Sunday evening on ABC. The anchor is Forrest Sawyer, so we thought we'd use the occasion to invite him to talk with us about his career in journalism. Sawyer often substitutes for Ted Koppel on Nightline. He reported from the Middle East for 8 months. During the Gulf War, he broke the Pentagon's policy on pool reporting and traveled independently with his crew and satellite dish. Sawyer started his network career at CBS, where he hosted a morning show with Maria Shriver. One of the reporters on Sawyer's new program is former NPR reporter and host John Hockenberry. I asked Forrest Sawyer what he hopes will separate his new program from the other news magazines.
Everyone keeps asking what's different about this program because news magazines are proliferating so much on television. And the answer is we're not going to reinvent the wheel, but we are trying to create a little different form. The first piece, for instance, in the very first program is going to be 32 minutes without commercials. That's quite unusual for a news magazine. Most of them are 11 minutes, 11 minutes, 11 minutes, and Andy Rooney. So we're going to expand the form. We're playing with editing, and we're fiddling around with some of the subject matter as well. So it'll, I think, be a little edgier and put together a little differently.
You've recently been exposed to two very different kinds of pressures, the pressure of war reporting and the pressure of starting a new show. With one, your life is at stake. With the other, your career is on the line. Do those two pressures get to you in different ways?
I sort of like the former and try not to think about the latter.
You like your life being on the line?
Actually, I kind of do. I know that sounds odd, but I am of that weird breed that likes to go into those dicey situations and find it enjoyable. Because as you get closer out to the edge there, as you're driving into Kuwait City ahead of the American forces, and there's nothing but Iraqis and scared Kuwaitis up ahead of you, things get clearer. People don't lie out there on the edges. They don't have time. And a certain sort of endorphin rush, I suppose, begins to kick in. So I do like that a lot. The career stuff, I don't like it all.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a little bit about your work on Nightline. What's the typical day like when you're anchoring?
Not as hectic as you might imagine, unless it's a breaking story. If it is an ordinary day, it starts about 11 o'clock in the morning with batting around two or three stories that are hanging up in the air. Then people that are called bookers, body snatchers as they're euphemistically called in the business, go out and try to round up some guests to talk about the topic. You have a brace of people who are crashing together a story that will run about 8 minutes at the very top of the broadcast. And what I am doing is studying for a final exam.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to like a lot of material on something and just go through it and go through it and go through it and go through it. And then finally, when I get there, I throw it all away so that I actually listen to what the person is saying rather than trying to read a list of questions or something like that. And then you do a little writing going into the program.
How would you describe your approach to getting people to tell you the truth when you're interviewing them on Nightline? Do you think that your style is different from Ted Koppel's?
I think probably it's different. Ted is perhaps a little more confrontational than I am. You're doing live television, and at the end of the day, it really comes down to 2 6-minute segments. That's all it is. It appears to be a half hour, but when you're finally talking about just the interviewing itself, you have one or two or three people in 2 6-minute segments. So you have to go straight for the jugular. You can't waste time circling around, building up, trying to do what you might do if it was a taped interview. And you set the parameters, and you operate in a little bit like a lion tamer when there are several people going at each other's throats.
What was it like the first night you anchored Nightline? Were you nervous about it?
Scared to death. Scared to death. One of the earliest shows, a wonderful ABC News producer named Rick Kaplan, who now produces Primetime, who came to me only a month after I had been at ABC and said, come on over and do Nightline. I said, you know, you really can't do this to me. I'm scared. I can't. He said, that's all right. We'll book flights to four different locations under assumed names for you the next morning. You're going to be all right. And I shortly thereafter did a program on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And to show how good Rick was as a producer, they did this tape. And we had Mr. Khrushchev's son and the son of somebody else from Moscow. And I went to Mr. Khrushchev's son, and he had trouble speaking English. He began talking in Russian back to me. So I said, well, I'm hurting here, but I'll go over to the next guy. And I asked him a question, and unfortunately, he stuttered. So if I hadn't had Robert McNamara there, and all you have to do is say, Mr. McNamara, can you give me the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis? I'm going out for donuts. I would have been in terrible trouble. But Rick was able to cut that together and actually make it look like I wasn't a complete fool.
I guess it's Forrest Sawyer, and he anchors a new ABC News magazine called Day One that begins this Sunday evening. Many people singled you out for outstanding reporting during the Gulf War. Did you volunteer for the assignment?
Did more than volunteer for the assignment. I was a tremendous troublemaker over there. I hated the pool system. If you remember, the pool system was the way the military would round people up and allow them to go where they wanted them to go, and they'd pack a little field lunch for you, and it was like going on a school trip. Take you to the library, and you get to talk to the people they wanted to talk to and bring you back. And I thought that wasn't news, that was public relations, and wanted to go out on my own. Unfortunately, Bob Simon and his crew had gotten picked up by the Iraqis at one point, and so everybody became very nervous about letting us go out on freelance runs or without the representation of the military there. You were subject to being arrested if you went beyond 100 kilometers. But I was rabble-rousing and saying, you know, we got to go. And finally, in fact, Ted Koppel lobbied to allow me to go for his broadcast, and we put on chocolate chips, those camouflage outfits that they wore in the desert, so that mm-hmm. we had a vague appearance like soldiers, and we sneaked through the checkpoints. I had managed to map all the checkpoints, and finally made it to the front and got some interesting pictures and first pictures of deserters and those kinds of things, which proved that it could be done and set the ground for us to be able to go out with a satellite.
How did you sneak through the checkpoints?
Kind of with attitude, just sheer attitude. I'd put on my military hat and kind of wave through and act like I was in a rush and had somewhere to go, and we had a sand-colored truck, and just bluffed our way through. They could have stopped at us at any point, and we'd wound up in the brig.
So you were passing yourself off as a military man?
I was not. I never said I was in the military.
No, but with the attitude you were giving was a military attitude.
Well, the attitude I was giving was that I was in a rush to get somewhere.
Right,
now,
okay.
If the military are in a rush, that's not my fault.
So these were American checkpoints?
Only a couple had American there. Happily, most of them were Saudis.
Mm-hmm.
And the Saudis thought that if they saw an American dressed like that with attitude, he must be in the military.
Yeah, because I'd imagine if there were American checkpoints, people would say, hey, there goes Forrest Sawyer. I mean, that's a problem you could really run into when you're trying to slip unnoticed and you're actually very well known in the country that you're from.
Well, not with sunglasses and a three-day-old beard.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to look more like Robin Williams after a couple of bad nights.
So your editors at ABC finally supported you in breaking away from the press pool?
They did, and we went out and got what I think was a terrific story, which was the first television report from the front itself. And the first pictures of the actual air bombing that was going on and some Iraqi deserters, just by sheer happenstance, drove up to the earth berm where we were situated, right on the front, and gave themselves up in front of our camera. It was just sheer luck. And so when we went back with that story, we had a lot more opportunities to go out on things like I went out with the Saudis in an F-15 on a bombing run and just operated entirely outside the auspices of the U.S. military.
Were there any guidelines that you followed for traveling independently and trying to keep safe?
It's real tricky because you can get into all sorts of situations. The only guideline that I would follow, I was traveling with my satellite dish during the actual ground war. I was traveling with six people. And I would have meetings, basically. I'd pull them all together, the satellite guys and my crew and a producer. And I'd say, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to literally drive into Kuwait City, and it's going to be dark, and there are going to be Iraqis there, and it could be unpleasant. Anybody who doesn't want to go doesn't have to go. And I would lay out the risks involved, and there's simply risks. You can't get around that.
What were the risks that you laid out?
That we could get killed, that the Iraqis might grab us and throw us in prison, or they might shoot us, or they might steal our truck and leave us out in the desert, or we might even run into friendly fire. I mean, we were running out there by ourselves. And what we actually ran into in Kuwait City, by sheer luck, I mean, most of this is luck, as we were driving around the city late at night and passed a number of Iraqis who were trying to wave our truck down so they could grab it and make a run for them, a white Mercedes stopped, and right in front of us, two guys with submachine guns got out and said, "Are you with the Americans that I just brought in?" And I said, "Excuse me?" He turned out to be from the Kuwaiti resistance and put us up at his house and wired us right into the Kuwaiti resistance. So within a matter of 2 hours of getting into Kuwait City, I knew everything that had been happening there from the Kuwaiti side.
Yeah, I guess that's the kind of serendipity that helps so much in a dangerous and unsure situation.
It's luck and opportunity, those two things, and you know, chutzpah at some point.
Yeah. What was your timing? When did you decide this is the moment for us to try to get into Kuwait?
Well, I had originally decided that I thought the war was going to last longer than it did. I thought it was going to be at least a week, and I thought gas would be used. Gas could be delivered by artillery, probably not by Scuds. So Scuds didn't bother me, but if you went to the front and you were facing artillery shells, then there could be some problems. So I went around way to the west with the Arab forces where I thought there would be strong fighting. Instead, everybody gave up. They just started pouring in. It was a very surreal scene, walking in this cloud of smoke, dropping their weapons and their gas masks and holding their arms up and saying, "Please give us food." And it became very clear that we had to get to Kuwait City fast. And I was in the wrong place. And I also had a truck that didn't work. It had broken down. So we were in terrible shape. And I went over to a guy who was with the U.S. Special Forces, an advisor to the Saudis. And I said, "Oh, I got to get to Kuwait City. You got to help me out here. What can I do?" And he said, "Well, you can stay with us. I believe we'll get there about August, the way we're going." The Saudis were not moving fast. They stopped, they'd have tea, they'd pray. He said, "Or you can just cut across there. That's a shortcut, but I believe the landmines will get you. Or you can go all the way back into Saudi Arabia and take a left turn and go all the way back on the east side," which is what we wound up ultimately doing, going into a little town. I begged, borrowed, and stealed a truck there from a guy who ran a baby products store. I promised him my firstborn, my producer, anything he wanted, and then just made a screaming run at about 100 miles an hour for several hours to try to get into Kuwait City when we finally got there.
Who did the driving?
Well, there was a convoy. There were four trucks, but I drove one of them. I drove the lead truck.
Mm-hmm. So you're good at driving 100 miles an hour?
When I've got Rune Arledge back in the United States. Yes, I do. Rune Arledge is the president of ABC News, and he's much more terrifying than the Kuwaitis.
So did you expect expect to get to Kuwait ahead of the American troops, or was that just luck that you beat them?
When I started out for the run, it didn't make any difference. I just had to get to Kuwait City, and I had gotten a pass from the head of the Arab forces, a piece of paper saying that I could have my satellite dish, which meant I was unarrestable by the Americans. They couldn't pick me up. I was traveling with a free ride. So if the war had lasted longer, I would have been able to just roam anywhere that I wanted to. And I got to a certain point, and somebody or other told me that CBS had already gotten there and was reporting. And then an hour and a half, 2 hours later, I got there and started reporting. And the luck of it was that we got to the Kuwaiti resistance first.
Mm-hmm. Who gave you permission to have a satellite dish?
Khalid bin Sultan, who was General Schwarzkopf's counterpart with the Saudis. You may remember that there was the Arab force and the American force, and there was some back and forth about who has control and so on. Ultimately, of course, the Americans did, but not if you asked General Khalid. And frozen out by the Americans, I began to develop relationships on the Arab side. And he just came to trust me and said, "Okay, take a satellite dish out and do some reporting. Have fun."
So when you got to Kuwait, what were the first things you wanted to show Americans?
First things I wanted to know were, What's happening to the Kuwaiti people? How many Iraqis are still in town? Who's in control of this city? What are you doing for food? And those kinds of immediate questions. After it began to be settled that the Iraqis had either fled or were being picked up by the Kuwaiti resistance, and the Americans and the Arab forces were beginning to move in, I think a day and a half, 2 days later after I'd gotten there, the next questions were, what happened here? And I began moving toward the issue of atrocities. Mm-hmm. And ran into a number of one wonderful doctor who had risked his life with a little tiny camera that he kept hidden in his hospital. And whenever a victim of atrocity was brought in, he and two other doctors would smuggle this camera out, snap a photo at the risk of his life, at the risk of torture, and then try to hide the camera somewhere back in the hospital. And this went on the whole time of the occupation. And he came to me and he said, I've got this film. Can you develop it for me? And I took it to, I believe, Associated Press. And I said, really important film, guys. Can you develop it? They did. And it was all fogged.
Mm.
All the film was bad. And so he had risked his life finally for naught. And he just broke down and cried. But those kinds of things, it was just one thing after another of seeing what the city had gone through. And then, quite frankly, I saw the horror of watching the Kuwaiti resistance, whom I had come to admire very much, being pushed aside by the government that had been living in Taif in Saudi Arabia at a five-star hotel and came frolicking back into town and just disregarded the Kuwaiti resistance, the ones who had kept people alive and fed and with contacts to the outside world with their own satellite phones, just pushed them aside and took back over again. And now Kuwait is as it was before, which is not such a pretty place.
Right. My guest is Farah Sawyer, and he's anchoring a new news magazine for ABC called Day One. It begins this Sunday. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Farah Sawyer is my guest, if you're just joining us. I'm interested in finding out a little bit about your own background. I know your father was a career naval officer. Did you grow up on military bases?
In my younger years, lived in Jacksonville when he was at the Jacksonville Naval Air Station. However, when I was about 8 years old, he had finished up his 20 years and decided he would like to go to my mother's parents' farm in Central Florida and be a farmer, because he would be on his own then. He wouldn't have any bosses like he'd had in the military all that time. And knew nothing about farming, unfortunately. We became known as the single most unsuccessful farming family in Polk County's history. There's a plaque to us somewhere in the town.
Did you like living on a farm? Did you find it boring, exciting?
It was my mother and father and my brother and me, and I truly hated it. We really were the most unsuccessful farming family in Polk County. That's not a joke. We would put up fences to keep our Angus cattle in, and they would just walk through the fence. they would laugh at us on the other side.
So what were your passions in your younger years?
Trying to avoid hoeing the orange trees. I got really good at hiding in various places and kind of doing a low crawl to my room. Sports and girls once I hit puberty.
Mm-hmm. Now, I read that you were a class president in high school. Did you ever want to be a politician?
No, not after having been class president. That was bad enough. More importantly, I was a disc jockey in high school in my junior and senior years, which is a far better thing than to be a class president, which is kind of a nerdy thing. Being a disc jockey at, handling the 10 o'clock shift on a Friday or a Saturday night is extremely cool when you're in high school.
Okay, now in college you majored in Eastern philosophy and world religion.
Now it's turning ugly today.
Wait, you and I know that the people who are the real career achievers do not major in Eastern philosophy and world religion.
I know. I don't know. I was heading toward the monastery and took a wrong turn, and I'm here now.
You weren't really heading toward the monastery, were you?
No, I was just interested in how other cultures thought. This is the 60s, and I was wandering around and occasionally going to the anti-war rally and wondering what the heck was going on here. And I was really interested in Buddhism and Hinduism, and particularly interested in Mahatma Gandhi.
It does seem like an odd choice for somebody who ended up in such a high-pressure profession.
I guess, but, you know, it allows me to remain calm in the center of the storm.
Right. And then you were going for a doctorate in wildlife management. So
see,
how did you end up in TV?
Isn't this just incredibly silly? I don't know. I just, everything went blank. The truth is that I had been broadcasting for a long time. I'd put myself through college in radio.
Oh.
And I was a sort of journeyman radio type whenever I needed to be. I loved going to study various things. I studied all kinds of things. And whenever I needed money, I could just get a job in radio.
News radio, rock and roll radio?
All the above. I got into journalism at a certain point and probably didn't go back.
So how did you get from radio to TV?
I did a lot more interviews than you do in a single day. I did 8 per day, live. And was just getting blind from trying to do all that studying and mm-hmm. and know what was going on. And mm-hmm. I was a little bored mm-hmm. from the constant rotation of things. So I decided to do a Sunday talk show or something on the local stations. You know how horrible they often are? It's just terrible. They're sitting around in uncomfortable chairs talking about city taxes. And I said, you can do better than this. And they gave me an audition, and instead they offered me the 11 o'clock anchor job. Now, had I known what I was getting into, maybe I would have gone to the monastery instead, but it ultimately worked out. It's just hard to figure out television. It's weird.
Your new program begins this Sunday. A trivial point, but is this the first of the news magazines that has one anchor instead of two?
No, 48 Hours has Dan Rather.
True, okay.
Street Stories has Ed Bradley.
Right.
And
true
is that
enough.
It?
That's true
it,
enough.
I think.
Okay. Because usually it's, you know, girl host, boy host kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe they're running out of people now. Everybody used to have their 15 minutes of fame. It's now everybody will have 15 minutes of news magazine.
That's good.
It's true. It's awful. You know how these competitive stories are? They're just unbelievable out there. Because everybody has to get the story exclusively.
Right.
You know, if Dateline gets the story, we're not going to do it. And if we get the story, Prime Time's not going to do it. So we're all swarming these stories, trying to talk sources into letting us do the story and give us the access that we want. So when you go to sources now, you have to take a number, like at a deli, and wait to talk to them. We're offering a set of dishes to anybody who will actually let us do the story.
But this must be so frustrating for you, because you were telling us how you really like being an independent reporter on a story in Kuwait, breaking away from the pool and everything. And it's in a way like being in a different kind of pool when you're after a lot of the same stories that the other networks are after, and you're bidding for the right to the story and for exclusivity and so on.
It's tricky. It's tricky. The big stories are like that. The trick is to be creative enough to take a bit of a different tack and go wandering off in fields that haven't been tilled too much. I mean, I think we're the first, you know, news magazine that's actually going to have a regular agricultural report. For instance, that's a joke, too. No. You can watch. It's all right. There will not be an agricultural report, I swear.
Well, I thought maybe this would be your ode to farming,
yeah.
Waxing nostalgic for those early days of hoeing the orange trees.
The lost family farm.
Well, good luck with the show. Thanks so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Terry.
Forrest Sawyer, he anchors the ABC News magazine Day One. It premieres Sunday evening. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a World War II controversy about the atom bomb that continues into the 90s. During the war, American intelligence planned to kill or kidnap Werner Heisenberg, the German physicist heading up German atom bomb research. We'll talk with journalist Tom Powers, who says it's lucky we didn't kill Heisenberg. Powers' new book offers evidence that Heisenberg sabotaged development of the bomb. And if you missed the pay-per-view special of the tribute to Bob Dylan last fall, you've got a second chance to see it. Public TV is airing its version of the concert this week, along with a tribute concert to Stephen Sondheim. TV critic David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City at the UN, U.S. officials have called for an urgent meeting of the Security Council to talk about the latest Serbian military offensive. According to Bosnia's diplomats, there are increased reports of massacres. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The U.S. call for a Security Council meeting to consider the latest Serbian offensive comes amidst concern that peace negotiations here could collapse. Mohamed Shokerbi, Bosnia's ambassador to the UN, says the military action raises questions about the Serbs' commitment to peace. He says that it's now up to the Security Council to take action.
Massacres are occurring in the Terska region. Women, children, and men are being murdered indiscriminately. Something needs to be done immediately.
It's difficult to predict what effective action the Security Council can take. Until now, the Council has resisted any kind of military involvement, and there are no indications diplomats have changed their thinking. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Top U.S. officials have countered indications that airdrops into Bosnia might be curtailed after 3 days. As President Clinton said, airlifts will continue as planned. His statement today, and one by Secretary of State Warren Christopher, cleared confusion over a comment made last night by Secretary of Defense Les Aspin that a third U.S. airdrop might be the last for a while. Only yesterday, Moscow had said for the first time it is now willing to help in these airdrops. The U.S. has been trying to get Russia involved in peacemaking efforts in Bosnia. A White House spokesman says that a U.S. team will leave soon for Moscow to talk about Russian participation in airdrops into eastern Bosnia. Police in Germany raided the homes of suspected right-wing extremists today in a crackdown which coincides with political developments in Bonn. Lynn Weil reports.
The sweep covered 3 states, 2 of them in eastern Germany. Police seized an undisclosed amount of guns and ammunition, computers, documents, and a bust of Adolf Hitler. Some of the 50 men and boys arrested are thought to be members of the Nationalistic Front, a neo-Nazi group banned last November as the government in Bonn began cracking down on extremists after a year-long spate of attacks on foreigners and Jewish memorials in Germany. Right-wing groups have justified the violence by claiming that foreigners are ruining their land. On Thursday, the parliament begins reviewing the nation's constitutional provision allowing people to seek political asylum in Germany. Their numbers would be drastically reduced by the proposed change in the law, which would allow the immediate deportation of asylum seekers to all the countries bordering Germany. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Weil in Bonn.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 3 points to close at 3,404.04 on volume of more than 272 million shares. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has approved and sent back to the House a bill to extend jobless benefits to the long-term unemployed. Approval of the $5.7 billion package came after a GOP effort to pay for the plan with government spending cuts was turned down. Senate Democrats voted to keep the president's economic package intact, but the Senate did add on an amendment that freezes the pay of Congress at $133,600 for 1 year. And this has to be voted on by the House before the bill goes to the White House. President Clinton has ordered a 6-month review of government operations to be led by Vice President Al Gore. While similar efforts have been attempted by new presidents in the past, the Clinton administration has labeled its effort revolutionary. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Clinton said his initiative is an historic step in reforming the federal government. Vice President Gore says it marks the beginning of a revolution in government. Their remarks are reminiscent of Ross Perot's campaign rhetoric. Perot stirred up the deep-rooted belief held by most Americans that government is largely bloated and inefficient. President Clinton's agency-by-agency review is patterned after a program launched 2 years ago by Texas Governor Ann Richards. The Texas legislature adopted recommendations that achieved $2.4 billion in savings. The president emphasized today that the goal of his initiative is not simply to cut spending. The aim, he said, is also to improve the quality and delivery of federal programs. The most discussed feature of the initiative announced today is a series of toll-free 800 numbers for federal employees to call and report waste, fraud, and abuse. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Dr. Albert Sabin, who developed the oral polio vaccine, has died in Washington. He was 86. Since the vaccine was used in the U.S. in 1962, it's been credited with saving 5 million people from polio. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Why didn't German physicists develop the atom bomb during World War II? My guest, Tom Powers, is the author of a new book about the secret history of the German bomb. Powers is best known for his 1979 book, The Man Who Kept the Secrets, Richard Helms and the CIA. Powers' new book is called Heisenberg's War. Werner Heisenberg was the physicist who headed the German bomb project. The Allies feared Heisenberg was brilliant enough to succeed. American intelligence developed a plan to kidnap or assassinate him. The plan was dropped after a couple of years. Physicists in America have long debated whether Heisenberg bungled the bomb project or intentionally slowed it down to prevent Hitler from getting his own atom bomb. After 5 years of research, Powers concludes that Heisenberg sabotaged the bomb project. Although Heisenberg never quite said that, Powers says there were unmistakable signs that something was going on.
Heisenberg definitely told officials that the job was too big, and he convinced them, and they dropped the program. So why did Heisenberg do this? Well, it could be for the reason that he said. He thought it was too big, and that was that. But there are some other telltale signs. Heisenberg was in touch with people who were in touch with Allied intelligence authorities. And a friend of his sent a message to the United States in 1941 saying, among other things, Heisenberg himself tries to delay the work as much as possible. 1941. You know, it seems very clear to me, when you put all these things together, that Heisenberg deliberately took advantage of his authority and his prestige to kill that program.
What did he do to sabotage the program?
Well, you know, when you're thinking about embarking upon a gigantic program of scientific innovation, you can't just decide to go ahead and build it. You know, the military would love to build an anti-gravity machine. You can't just decide to build an anti-gravity machine. You got to ask scientists if this is possible and feasible. So the German authorities, who were very interested in building a bomb from the first day of the war, went and asked a German scientist if they could do it. And these questions came to a kind of a climax at a meeting in Berlin in June of 1942. That was, purely by chance, the very month in which the United States bomb program really got seriously going. And Albert Speer, who was the German Minister of Munitions and a kind of a economics czar, and a man who had the power to really put the whole weight of the country behind a bomb program, went to hear the scientists, especially Heisenberg, tell them whether or not it was possible to build a bomb. And Speer has left a quite vivid account of this encounter with Heisenberg, and at every turn in that meeting, Heisenberg just said, "It's too hard, it's too big, it's too uncertain, it's too expensive, we don't know when we'll succeed." He gave very discouraging advice indeed. In fact, at one point, Speer asked him if Heisenberg could guarantee that the experiments would not lead to the incineration of the planet. Now, that's a serious concern. And Heisenberg said to him, "Well, you know, we just can't promise. It could happen." So this was very discouraging to Speer in every way. And the program was reduced to a kind of a small, low-level research effort, largely to develop a reactor. They could have gone the other way, you know. These scientists could have done what the scientists in the United States did. They could have said, "This is potentially the most powerful and influential weapon of the war. We've got to go throw everything into it. There's a good chance we can succeed in time to use it before the war is over. Let's go for it." And in that case, I'm sure that Speer would have said, okay, because what else could he say?
But what makes you think that Heisenberg didn't truly believe that it was going to be too expensive, too difficult, too dangerous to build the bomb?
Well, think about it for a minute. How could he know? He doesn't know how to build a bomb. Nobody knew how to build a bomb in the beginning. The question is, do you want to or do you not want to? It's going to be difficult for sure. But there's no absolute answer to the question, too big or too difficult. The German state had the capacity to put real resources behind programs that it was interested in. You remember they built rockets that rained down on England at the end of the war, and these rockets were completely useless as military weapons without a big bomb on the end of them, which they didn't have. So they could have pressed the government to go forward very easily, but didn't.
After the war, several German scientists, including Heisenberg, were held captive in a country house known as Farm Hall, held captive by the Allies. And as they were held captive there, there was not much to do, you say, except to talk, and their conversations were recorded secretly by hidden microphones. Did you get access to those recordings?
These recordings were transcribed at the time and probably made a tremendous record of some sort. They're very interesting because they have extended sections of conversation among 10 German scientists who did not really know that they were being listened in on, for sure. And on the night of August 6th, for example, 1945, they learned about Hiroshima and realized that a bomb had been built, and this came to them as a tremendous shock. And they all began talking feverishly about it. These transcripts read, in some sense, almost like a play. You've got this very intense intellectual engagement with what happened and many different personal reactions. There were many small details there of very great interest to somebody who's really obsessed with what happened, and I have to confess that for a while I became really obsessed with what happened.
So what details in the transcripts support your theory that Heisenberg intentionally sabotaged the bomb program?
The shock on the part of the Germans that the Americans not only had done it, but had used it, they were deeply surprised by this. They never protested or made any kind of a claim that the Allied scientists shouldn't have done it, but they were shocked. And Heisenberg and a couple of his friends, in particular Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker and Otto Hahn, both talked at length and were overheard by these British intelligence officers talking about how they felt about it. And they were really sick at the idea of having built a bomb. Otto Hahn at one point said to a friend there that he got down on his bended knee to thank God that he had not built a bomb. This was a terribly distressing thing to him. He had been an inventor of fission, and the idea that his invention had killed scores of thousands of people in Japan was very painful to him. And there are a lot of conversations of that kind that I think make it abundantly clear that these scientists totally lacked the passionate zeal required to successfully launch and carry out a bomb program.
My guest is Thomas Powers, author of the new book Heisenberg's War, The Secret History of the German Bomb. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Powers. What kind of reaction have you gotten from physicists to your interpretation that Heisenberg intentionally sabotaged the German bomb?
When we're talking about the physicists who actually were active in the 20s and 30s and knew Heisenberg and were involved in this period, they're interested by many things that I discovered, sometimes fascinated. Many things became clear to them that they had never understood because they would only know one part of the story, and then I would tell them some other part that they'd never known about. But I have to tell you, they have a lingering suspicion and visceral dislike, resentment of Heisenberg for having stayed in Germany, even though it seems increasingly likely to them, I think, that Heisenberg clearly did not try to build a bomb and, in fact, was responsible for kind of running the program into a closet. Nevertheless, this guy stayed in Germany. And many of them lost members of their families during the Holocaust, and they just don't want to forgive him 100%.
Have you found a moral in this story?
Well, I found a couple of morals. I don't know if anybody else finds them. The first moral is, think twice, think three times before deciding that you want to assassinate somebody as a matter of policy. It's very, very difficult to know, really, who your enemies are. That's one clear lesson. We tried to kill a man who I think, you know, did us a very great favor indeed. And another lesson to be gained from this, I think, is an important one about science itself. You know, scientists have received much of the blame for bringing us into the nuclear age. For 50 years, we've been living under a cloud of danger, and people don't like it. And they're fearful of these nuclear weapons, and they blame the scientists for being tinkerers who just went ahead and built these terrible weapons of mass destruction because governments asked them to, just as if these scientists had no sense of moral responsibility. But if you look at what Heisenberg really did, I don't see any way to interpret his actions and behavior except by saying that he had a sense of moral responsibility. And when you see that clearly, you begin to reinterpret what some other scientists did in the early days of nuclear invention. You know, J. Robert Oppenheimer, who was the technical director at Los Alamos, went ahead and worked very hard to build an atomic bomb. But by the time the government asked him to build a hydrogen bomb, he had completely turned around, and he had begun to sound a lot like Heisenberg. And one of the leading Russian physicists who was asked to build a bomb in Russia, Peter Kapitsa, he resigned in 1946. He sent a letter to Stalin and said, I don't want to work on this program any longer. And he quit. It's interesting that all of these guys insisted that they were never politically or morally opposed to building these terrible weapons. But what they actually did was try and find ways to get out of it and not to do it.
Sounds like you're criticizing the scientists in America who did work on the bomb.
No, I don't mean to criticize them for that. This was a complex situation and a very dangerous one, and Heisenberg always recognized that the scientists among the Allies were in a completely different situation. They were facing Hitler. I mean, the Allies wanted to build a bomb because they were afraid of Hitler. And Heisenberg, I think, didn't want to build a bomb because he was afraid of Hitler. They shared those basic values. Having thought about nuclear weapons now for a dozen years and spent a lot of time looking into it, I would have to say that I do not have any sense of anger or resentment at the scientists who went ahead and built these things. In fact, I think an argument can be made that not only did they invent them, but they invented our ways of thinking about them. Not only did they give us these weapons, but they gave us principles of international cooperation, which have eventually led to the reduction of their danger.
You've been writing about the CIA since the 1970s. The CIA is in transition now. There's a new director, James Woolsey. The CIA is in the post-Cold War era. How do you think the CIA needs to redefine itself?
Well, I think it needs to be a smaller agency. The Cold War has come to an end, and the giant military establishment that was built to fight the Cold War is in the state of being reduced and shrunk down to size, and I think that should happen to the CIA as well. But there are still a lot of important things for the CIA to do. One thing, for example, is that there are numerous nuclear weapons in the Soviet Union that could easily slip out of state control and fall into the wrong hands. And that is a kind of a problem that would require a lot of intelligence manpower. And the CIA could do work of that kind, which would be useful and important. There have been suggestions that the CIA would be a great handmaiden to American business. This, I believe, is a disastrous proposal. The idea that we're going to turn the black arts of the CIA loose in the world in order to make it safe for American business and give American entrepreneurs an edge in international competition, boy, this strikes me as a terrible idea. We don't actually conduct our economic life on the planet at that level of animosity and limitless competition, and we shouldn't start. So I would hope that the CIA would not be used by the administration to go off on crack-brained schemes to help American business.
Don't the people who support industrial espionage say that other countries are already engaged in it against us?
Yeah, they do say that. And that's a good reason for trying to stop them from doing it. Other people are engaged in the drug trade. That isn't a reason for getting into it. That's a reason for trying to stop them. So if there are examples of industrial espionage, and of course there are, I think we should try and bring it under control and limit it. And that is a useful job for intelligence.
A question I've been wanting to ask you for a while. It seems to me it's hard to publish a book about the CIA without getting you to write a blurb for it. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
And I wonder if you ever feel put upon, because I'm sure every time a book about the CIA comes out, it gets shipped off to you in galleys, and the publisher asks you to write a blurb for it.
Terry, it's very hard to write a book. It takes a long time, and for the most part, it's a poorly paid endeavor. When some guy who has gone to all the trouble to write a book about the CIA asked me to say something about it for a blurb, I generally say, okay, I want to help the guy. And what I do is I read the book and I find the best thing in it I can say about it. And I say that as a general rule. Now, I don't mean to say that I give a blurb to everybody who asks, because I don't. But I'm friendly to the idea. You know, it's tough out there and you're pretty much alone, and I'd like to help them. Other people have helped me.
Well, obviously you've learned a lot about how to get secret information. Do you think you'd make a good spy?
Well, no, and I'll tell you why. I take forever. Spies need to find out stuff in a hurry.
Right. They don't have 5 years, huh?
They don't have 5 weeks as a rule. You know, somebody wants to know, they want to know right away. And I used to work as a journalist, and I enjoyed that. You know, it's really fun to be a young man and run around New York and be a journalist. But I discovered after a while that I had a taste for sort of getting deeper into the story. You know, I wanted to know what was really going on here. And it's gotten worse.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Thomas Powers is the author of the new book, Heisenberg's War, The Secret History of the German Bomb. This is Fresh Air. NPR's John Burnett is still in Waco, Texas. Let's check in with Linda Wertheimer and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We expect to hear from John and see what has happened today in Waco and what they think may happen. We also have an interview with someone from the Child Protective Services in the town of Waco about the children who've come out and what their condition is. We have a report on the Bosnia airdrop, which is continuing. The president is talking about cutting waste and releasing 800 numbers, a la Ross Perot. We have an interview with Walter McMillan, who was released from death row, and an interview with novelist P.D. James.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, public television presents two concert fundraising specials. One pays tribute to Bob Dylan, the other, Stephen Sondheim. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
No sense denying it anymore. It's official. I'm old. I knew it was coming anyway because I'm about to turn 40. But you know you're old when music and musicians you loved as a kid show up on PBS during pledge periods. When public TV and I were about 20 years younger, the fundraising specials featured Mel Torme and Buddy Rich. Now PBS figures one way to get viewers to pledge money is to have Tom Petty singing, well, listen.
Where's going you when you're trying to be so good? Where's going you just do like they said they would? Where's going you when you're trying to go home? Where's going you when you're there all alone? But I would not feel so all alone. Everybody must get stoned.
This In the Spotlight special is a two-part TV version of last fall's Bob Dylan 30th Anniversary Tribute Concert, the same concert that was broadcast live on pay-per-view. That means Eric Clapton does a great version of Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, and Neil Young rips through All Along the Watchtower, and there are good performances by George Harrison, Stevie Wonder, Tracy Chapman, Richie Havens, The Band, and a lot more. But the makers of this special have added and rearranged a few things, so it's not the same as the pay-per-view show. One of the most notable additions is Bob Dylan's solo finale of Girl from the North Country, which he sang for the Madison Square Garden audience after the pay-per-view TV concert had ended.
So if you're traveling in a North Country fair, where the wind's in heavy on the butterline. Remember me, anyone who lives there. She once was a true love of mine.
And the other bonus is a pre-concert interview and rehearsal clip of Sinead O'Connor, who was booed off the stage that night. We get to hear not only the song she had intended to perform, but also what Dylan meant to her personally.
God, he kept me alive. He literally kept me alive. Like, if it wasn't for him, I would not have survived my, you know, life growing up with that. Like, he was the one thing that was there that told me I wasn't crazy and that I was going to survive and stay alive.
But there are things left out of this concert special, too, like Dylan singing Song to Woody and George Harrison singing If Not For You. Why they're missing, I have no idea, but cutting songs out of concert specials seems to be pretty popular these days. The Sondheim tribute show on Great Performances, a TV version of last summer's Carnegie Hall concert, cuts out a lot of them. But even with a half dozen songs missing, it's a great show, and it's got some terrific numbers. Even some wonderful songs from the movie Dick Tracy and the workshop version of Assassins, as well as from his Broadway hits Company, Follies, and Sweeney Todd. The showstoppers include Patti LuPone doing Being Alive, Bernadette Peters doing Not a Day Goes By, and Dorothy Loudon doing a great job on a crazy medley, literally, that pairs the tragic Follies song Losing My Mind with the happy Company song You Could Drive a Person Crazy. The best thing about Loudon's performance, maybe, is a one-word change in Sondheim's lyrics. In 1970, the word that he rhymed with bag was fag. But times have changed in Sondheim's world, too, and the audience at the tribute picks up on it immediately.
Lord, I could understand a person if it's not a person's bag. I could understand a person if a person was a drag. But worse than that, a person that titillates a person and then leaves her flat is crazy.
Both specials are terrific, but both of them are so good that I don't understand why they weren't packaged and offered as complete events. When you've got artists and music of this caliber, less is not more. More is more.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jane Perlez about her years as the New York Times correspondent in Africa. She covered the war and famine in Somalia long before the rest of the media was there. And we'll talk with journalist Raymond Bonner, who covered El Salvador and wrote a book about the Philippines before reporting from Africa. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.